With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight back. It's time for the publisher fight back.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm editor-in-chief of Video Ad News, which will soon be rebranding to Video Week. This week's guest is Rishad Tabakawala, who is senior advisor to Publicis Group. They're the world's third largest agency holding group, and Rishad served as both chief growth officer and as chief strategist. He's also the author of a new book, Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data, which is a business book. It's not just about advertising. It's very relevant for our times, and I think has become even more relevant since the pandemic kicked off. On our side, we have just started work on the video and OTT advertising guide for this year. It's something that we'll be launching in September. We've been doing these guides for a few years now, and they've been extremely well received by the industry. If your company would like to take part, just get in touch via the Video Ad News website and let us know. Now I'll cross over to my conversation with Rishad. He's somebody that I think I could listen to all day, and I think you're about to see why. Great to have you, Rishad. Quite conveniently, within the last hour, I saw a blog post that you sort of put out on Twitter, and you mentioned that the pandemic is probably far greater in terms of impact than anything else we've seen in the past five decades. How do you think the world's going to change, and why do you think this is going to be more disruptive than anything we've seen before?
There are three broad reasons, and I've been in business for four decades, and the reason I said five decades is before that there was World War II, which probably was monumental. But the first reason is, unlike the previous shocks we've had to the system, whether it was SARS and MERS or 9/11 or the Great Recession, all of those tended to basically come and have at their base either a health issue, a financial issue, or a socio-political issue, like 9/11. And this one is all three. While it started off clearly as a health issue, it very quickly became obviously a massive economic issue, but it also became a societal issue. And one of the key things that I took away from that was that society was showing signs of fragility. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. The second reason is, besides it being health and economic and political, is it's happened to everybody in the world at the same time. So even the Great Recession actually did not occur and did not really impact about 25% of the countries. And it really hurt a few countries, but not everybody in the world. And some countries actually didn't have a massive shock like China. So this one is affecting everybody in the world. And third is, it's something where all of us, unlike a lot of events that came and went, like let's say 9/11, or cascaded over time like the Great Recession, all of us were in lockdown for 60 to 90 days at around the same time in the world. And one of the key things that I've sort of discovered is that if you start or stop doing something for 60 to 90 days, you create a new habit. And so as a result, I truly believe coming out of this, we're looking at both a very fragile society where people are different, businesses are mostly much more at risk, especially obviously if you're in hospitality, in print, in the magazine business, and society. And I called out the society fragility, and I will just sort of speak to the United States where I currently am. So you've got 40 million people unemployed, but not only are they unemployed, but 40 million people have lost their health care, which makes no sense at all. When there's a health crisis, 40 million people lose their income and they lose their health care. So that, I think, is one shock. The other one, which I sort of called out, is African Americans in Chicago are about a third of the population, but they were two-thirds of the COVID-19 deaths. If you look at in the United States, 16% of the population is immigrant, but 30% of the frontline workers are immigrant. So there's these massive societal issues that we're beginning to show. And to a great extent, the George Floyd murder just set off this kindled fire that already existed, which is, you know, massive societal fracture lines being shown because of healthcare, because of the lack of diversity, a whole bunch of other things. So I do believe that coming out of this, we're going to, what I call, it's going to be the great reinvention, that people, business, and society will be different.
Earlier in the year, you wrote, well, I think, you know, when you were writing it, I'm sure you had no idea that it was going to be a pandemic, but it's quite timely. It was looking at, you know, restoring the soul of business, staying human in the age of data, which I think, you know, there's sort of various dimensions to the book, but one of the sort of, one of the big themes is the way technology and data are sort of affecting our workplaces, are determining company strategies for better and for worse. And, you know, sort of looking at everything from, you know, timekeeping to how we sort of use KPIs to measure employee performance. How do you think companies can, you know, sort of adapt to the changes that are to come? Is there any strategy, whether it's, you know, maintaining cohesiveness within your own workforce, or, you know, whether it's sort of pursuing new market opportunities in, you know, the new normal, or the new strange, I think, as you termed it?
Yes. Yes, I call this sort of the new strange, because it's not really new normal. And new normal, as you know, is a very strange word. It's like saying short and tall at the same time. There are, I think, a few things. The first is, I continue to believe that we're living in an age where data will be important. And, you know, as I sort of have said, data is like electricity. No company or business can do without it. On the other hand, I believe that companies so fixated on data, which is like fixating on electricity and thinking that you're going to differentiate yourself from the use of electricity. Nobody does that. And so a great extent is what, you know, you bring to the data, or what I call the spreadsheet. What stories do you bring to the spreadsheet? And today, when you look at the biggest challenges that we are now seeing all around the world, they are all human challenges, interestingly. They are, you know, obviously COVID-19, unemployment, society issues. You're basically seeing, you know, in the United States, Black Lives Matter and other emotional issues. And I've always basically believed that if you think that people were rational, and this is not necessarily a political statement, but it is, if people were rational, why would they elect Trump, right? If people were rational, after everything that someone has seen so far, 39% of America would still vote for Trump. That's not rationality. People are not rational. People choose with their hearts and they use numbers to justify what they just did. It's the reason why Facebook exists. Facebook is so you can live in your own polarized world with your own people who basically massage your thoughts. And so you have different people massaging thoughts. So I have truly believed that for organizations, as we move forward, you must pay attention to three key criteria. First and most important for me is your employees, which is, I don't believe a company can succeed. They cannot, it's no use talking about ESG and purpose and values if you can't look after your employees. It's complete and total bullshit. So, but your employees are people. And what we've discovered is people, in addition to wanting fame, power, and money, which are obviously important, and in the case of younger people, fame is recognition and power is autonomy, and everybody likes money. What people really stay and what companies actually succeed are when they have the ability to grow themselves, when they find purpose and values that are aligned with their own purpose and values aligned with the company, and where they find connections with people, with each other, et cetera. And, you know, one of the key things we're missing is the human connection in this sort of zoomed age. So my basic belief is, do use data, but let's start using data in the following way. Number one, let's use it for figuring out and getting how well your employees are feeling and what you can do to help grow your employees. create an environment where they are more likely to speak up and create an environment where they feel nurtured. And those are a big thing that you can numerically measure. So it's everything from, okay, what's your diversity in your workplace? But in addition to that, do you have diverse people in not only positions of power, but are they free to speak up? So how do you create an environment where people actually can speak up? A lot of people, you know, I wrote a piece called Diverse Faces Are Not the Same as Diverse Voices. So if people check the marks and say, look, we got people. I said, yeah, but they don't feel comfortable speaking up. So it doesn't matter whether you have them or you don't have them. So the first is, you know, utilizing data to try to evaluate how your employees are, making sure you have the right mix of employees and helping train the employees. And using very strong incentive plans, very much like you have incentive plans for management on return on capital, on increase in margin, to basically have those same measures on a bunch of employee things. Because if you have happy employees, you actually will have a successful business, or likely to have a successful business. And that's been proven over and over again, whether it's Southwest Airlines compared to United Airlines, or it's Microsoft after Satya Nadella and Microsoft before Satya Nadella. Okay. So when he went from basically telling people we're going to go to a learn it all mindset versus a know it all mindset, he basically got rid of Windows. He opened up to the world, and lo and behold, the company's stock price went up fourfold in 5 years. So I think those are, so what I'm trying to basically tell people is you got to think about the emotional side of business, but you can actually measure it, versus thinking only about the numerical side of business, or only thinking about the emotional side and not caring at all about measurement. So the emotional side, which is the story selling side of a business, without measurement would be something like WeWork. So WeWork was basically a hallucination. It wasn't a business. And you can see what a hallucination it was when you think that this was a business that was valued at over $60 billion, right, in fall of 2019. And the same business was valued at $2.7 billion 2 months ago. And Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan were trying to take this company public in late 2019 at $67 billion. And therefore, I will simply ask, whenever I talk to anybody at Goldman Sachs and I talk to anybody at JP Morgan Chase, I said, I don't know whether I can trust a single recommendation you make. Because you try to sell me a $2.7 billion company at $67 billion 6 months ago. Right? And so this is what I tell people is like, wake up and smell the coffee. Like, for instance, you probably have seen this, and if you've not, I posted something on LinkedIn, which links to an article in the New York Times by Ben Smith, who covers media for them. He was the editor of BuzzFeed, the BuzzFeed News. And there is an uprising, for instance, in all the newsrooms of America, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, etc. Because what they've discovered is all their leaders decamped and went to the Hamptons, okay, and left all of these people here. The biggest story, whether it's COVID-19 hitting the cities, whether it's the protests of Black Lives, and all the senior management are basically, you know, sitting by pools, they lost their company. It doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter what they say. And those are some of the things that I'm trying to get people to wake up, which is there is a revolution going on. And senior management is so, so concerned about how they look. And they're so incestuous with other senior management. Everybody blowing air kisses at each other and not knowing that the world is changing.
I think I agree. I think inequality is something we've spoken about for a long time. The stats have been stark for a very long time. And I think, you know, you don't have to be the sort of Communist Party students to sort of think that, you know, we are reaching a point where it's probably coming to a head and that things have to change, or they'll be changed for people. And I all the metrics suggest that we're in for a bumpy ride, I think, unless the system sort of solves it proactively itself.
Yeah.
Just to return to the data side of things, I mean, I think one of the things you sort of repeatedly stress in the opening of the book is that, you know, you're very much not a Luddite, and that you're, if anything, you're you're more from that mathematical data-driven background, but you're just arguing for that this other human dimension should be added. So, I mean, two of the sort of prominent initiatives taken at Publicis, I think they've probably been two of the most prominent on the agency side. The first was Marcel, and the second was the acquisition of Epsilon. I'm just curious how Marcel has evolved and how it's something that, you know, has worked in your business. I'd imagine that there were teething problems and, you know, but you mentioned before we started recording that, you know, you're doing a podcast with the industry, and it's being distributed via Marcel. So how is it being used today?
So to a great extent, when Marcel was first announced, you know, both internally and I think our CEO also himself sort of made note of it. It was basically somewhat of a joke, and it was somewhat resented because it was announced in a way that it felt like we were utilizing technology and funding it at the expense of not going to Cannes. And to a great extent, the idea, which was amazing, took some time to sort of execute. And as a result, there was a lot of like, what the hell is going on? Oddly, post-COVID-19, Marcel, which still is a work in progress and has a lot more yet to be done. And as you know, I'm no longer either an officer of a company or an employee of the company. So for the last 6-8 months, I'm not exactly sure what the underlying part of it, but someone who sort of sees it from outside or sees bits of it. It has done a few things. The first is, because it has allowed everyone in the world to be connected, and it is, you know, rather broadly available across Europe and the United States, for instance, which is a big part of our markets, it has saved hundreds, if not to thousands of jobs. That because of Marcel, what we've been able to do is there are some parts of our company and some markets which are doing relatively well. So for instance, Leo Bennett, the advertising agency here, has won a lot of business and needs to hire people. The pharmaceutical companies like Publicis Health, the ones on the Publicis Health, are doing very well. And now through Marcel, one of the key things is it's sort of an internal exchange of finding talent. So in effect, people are putting up and people all over the world are finding we're saving jobs. That's, you know, clearly one key thing. As you mentioned, one of the key things that I'm doing is I am hosting a podcast for the group where it's called What Next? And every week I speak to either an internal leader or an external person. You know, as I mentioned, Dan Snow from the BBC, or someone who runs next week, who runs China for us, to figure out what's going on in China. And that is distributed and accessible and discussed across Marcel. So in many ways, it took COVID-19 and 2 years for people to begin to understand that it was actually a good idea. You know, in hindsight, I would probably have made less noise about it, may not have announced it the way I would have announced it. Not that I was there, but I was obviously a part of the senior leadership. Therefore, I would say, yes, we should have announced it differently. But overall, as an idea, I think it's a tremendous idea. And I'm glad we have it versus not having it. So that's, you know, Marcel. You mentioned Epsilon, I guess?
Yeah. I think firstly, I mean, I think Epsilon is a company, I think many listeners to this, and I would include myself in this camp, we're familiar with the sort of traditional ad tech models and the various tools that can be used. And then a company like Epsilon is slightly confusing because it's a bit of a data behemoth and has lots of different things going on. So maybe just explain a bit what it is and then how it's being incorporated into Publicis' business today.
Yeah, so you know, Epsilon broadly, I mean, if you think about it, the best thing is, you know, sort of explain like what it potentially does. Just what it does, a lot of things, but here's an example. There's obviously a lot of importance in the world of sort of how do you leverage data to basically both build relationships, find audiences, etc. But how do you do it in a way that marketers can both ensure that they have some control over their future and that they haven't basically given their future away to a platform? And B is how do they stay on the right side, which is very important, of privacy and other regulations, right? And that they and one of the things that Epsilon does is, for instance, for many of the automobile companies, and I think in the United States, it's like 6 or 7 of the top 10 OEMs. It basically powers some or all of their customer relationship management, all the way not only from corporate, but all the way down to the dealer. And it's all sort of integrated. So, you know, to a great extent, managing that first party data in a way that is safe, leveraging it across your entire sort of journey, customer journey, whether it is basically from identifying or going to a GM website to basically purchasing a car, to getting it serviced over its lifetime, to the time that your lease ends. It's just one of the things that they basically do. The other is they work, and they've recently put together something with Publicis Media or PMX in what they call the PACT, which is they're leveraging their data and we're leveraging Publicis's media cloud in the United States. And these are for middle market companies, which I think are up to $1 billion in revenue. And we are guaranteeing outcomes, or Publicis, I'm no longer there, Publicis sort of guaranteeing outcomes. So the idea is today, a lot of marketers are very interested, given the issues that they face because of COVID-19, is how do I make sure that I get revenue? And so you're aware, we're basically saying, we guarantee you will get the revenue you need or the results, which obviously we are involved in setting. And as a result of that, otherwise you get your money back. Okay. So one of the key things it's also allowing us to do is do sort of guarantees, and, you know, marketers like that. So it's basically a combination of capabilities, people, and partnerships that allow marketers to better leverage first party and, you know, other data to differentiate themselves and make sure, I think, over time that we have marketers have additional options to just third parties or platforms. Not that third parties and platforms don't matter. They will always matter. But you need to have optionality. And I've written often that I truly believe that I've learned from the best marketers in the world that strategic optionality, which is that you have the ability to choose between partners, is very, very important. And what we're trying to do with Epsilon is provide them with us as another additional option to them.
I mean, when we see things like the PACT, have we finally cracked that thing of, there's been a frequent agency complaint over the years has been that, advertising is seen as an expense and not as an investment. I mean, have we reached a point where that conversation's almost a moot point where, a brand can't buy these outcomes?
Obviously, because there are different brands and they're different marketers and they're different industries, it's hard to give one sort of answer. But I will tell you how I sort of have approached it. And I continue to approach it. And, again, I'm not at Publicis. I advise a lot of clients. And so I have stayed with the same song. So unlike, a Martin Sorrell who sang one song for 38 years and sang the opposite song, I sing the same song because I probably don't have the imagination of, turning on 180 degrees from what I was doing before. But the song, which is very simply, is this. I believe that we're living in a world where you need the following things. You need massive amount of flexibility, and COVID-19 has shown why you need to have maximum flexibility. So companies that have basically said, okay, agencies don't matter and have taken a lot of it in-house, many of them are struggling with two realities. A, unlike us, they can't fire their internal people without massive severance. And a lot of people are asking, is it a point of focus? Why did we create an internal agency? Second is the entire media landscape has changed. The needs have changed. So you've got a whole bunch of old skill sets. And if you want to basically have flexibility of skill sets and you want to have flexibility of increasing and decreasing, the amount of people who work on a particular project, you have to use outside partners. You can't do it completely inside. It makes no sense. Okay. Now, again, for certain industries, you need to have more in-house than less in-house, clearly, in certain areas. So I'm not saying in-housing doesn't make sense, but having a majority of in-house in most categories makes zero sense because you can't fire yourself. You can't provide flexibility. Now, the other part is this. The nice thing about agencies, you know, we've been called all kinds of names, and I've given ourselves a name. So we've been called dinosaurs and a whole bunch of other stuff. I think we're cockroaches. Nobody likes us, but we scurry around and we kind of survive era after era after era. And for 40 years, I've heard about our death and destruction. And a lot of the people who talked about our death and destruction, including companies and press, have all died. And we're still around, scurrying around like a cockroach. Nobody necessarily loves us, but we're around. And by the way, cockroaches have outlasted everybody. Dinosaurs, everybody. Okay, so, I do understand in the hierarchy, you know, we're not a supermodel. We're not someone smart. We're just a cockroach. That's fine. But cockroaches have their uses. So, one of the key things that I've always basically believed is we are supplicants. At the most, we can say we're not supplicants, but we're on the best day, we're a junior partner. On a bad day, we're a vendor, and somewhere we're in between with our clients. But we cannot succeed without our clients. And so to a great extent, I've always basically believed, don't you want to have people whose success is highly dependent on them delivering for you? And a thing that I'm trying to remind people is, let's look at something like a Facebook or a Google. And these are two companies, by the way, that I admire. I have great friends in them. I speak at them. Both of their management have bought hundreds of my books. So this is not an anti-Facebook or anti-Google screen, because I don't believe our marketers and clients can succeed without them. And I use both of their platforms. But here's the key. If you look at Facebook, and I don't know the exact number, but that's somewhere between 60% to 75% of their revenue in the United States comes from outside the Fortune 500 companies. Okay, between 60 to 75%. So in effect, the entire Fortune 500 company, forget one particular client, doesn't matter to them. It doesn't matter. Yes, they have all these like councils and make you feel good. It doesn't matter. Right? So Facebook and Google will do whatever they want to do. Now, imagine an agency deciding that they do whatever they want to do. We'll be fired in 15 minutes. Okay? Because the reality of it is there is no option. If you want to basically be in social media, you have one choice in the United States. It's Facebook with a little bit of Twitter and a little bit of Snap, right? And now hopefully TikTok. If you want to have search, you have one choice, 85 to 90% of search. So in effect, it's not even a duopoly, you've got two monopolies. And by the way, most of these businesses, Facebook, Google, Amazon, there's only one way they can grow. I can tell you that there's only one way they can grow. And that is by disrupting our clients or the industries our clients operate in. They're gonna disrupt agencies. Think about it. The operating profit of Google this year will be greater than the market cap of all the five top holding companies combined. So my whole basic belief is it's only someone like a Martin Sorrell who calls them frenemies. You know, it's like me calling Michael Jordan on the basketball court frenemy. It just says I'm in the same place. Bullshit. You know, it takes a second for them to crush anything. But why would they come into a business which has no goddamn margin, that's valued at 1.5 times revenue on a good day, when they're in a business that's valued between 30 to 40 times revenue? So I use math. I use logic, math, and emotion to sort of explain that I think the real crisis, both on our side and on the marketer side, is a crisis of leadership. Okay. Obviously, I'm now neither a marketer nor an agency person, but I think it's a crisis of leadership where we aren't actually talking and facing what reality is. And the reality of it is that I believe marketing matters more than ever before, that there are some categories where I question the value that they add, like, for instance, finance. Okay, finance is 11% of GDP or 12% of GDP in the United States. Even today, Warren Buffett, and he's a brilliant man, amazing man, for the last 4 years, right, if you invested in Berkshire Hathaway, you wouldn't be a happy person. In fact, over the last 10 years, it's better off with S&P 500. And the last 2 years, it sucks, okay? Because the reality of it is we're living in a world where ETFs and a whole bunch of low-cost things can beat all managed money. So why all these buildings? Why all this hand-holding? Why 11% of GDP? Now let me tell you about storytelling, marketing, and innovation, which is what we do. It creates massive value, but we've not been able to say it and tell the story. We've just basically been supplicants. And you know why? Because I think, and this is my biggest worry, and this is the one that I'm like fixated on, and this is both client side and agency side. And I also now believe outside of Google, Facebook, and some of these platforms on most other media company side, is we have basically diluted talent. So we don't have the type of talent we need. And this includes, by the way, at the client, okay? And I'm not being an old fogey, but I can tell you, for every one person who leaves the agency to go to brighter pastures, there are two clients that do so. Mm-hmm. And we have a marketing leadership and talent problem, and we're trying to fix it through algorithms and other bullshit, hiring private detectives and God knows what other shit.
I'm going to make a segue from cockroaches to turds. And one of the things you mentioned in your book is, you know, this idea of the turd on the table, which, you know, which refers to, you know, the thing or the challenge for a company, perhaps, that nobody really wants to talk about. What's the turd on the table for agencies that they aren't facing up today? And I, as you've mentioned Martin Sorrell a couple of times, I think it'd be quite interesting to maybe speak about what he's doing with S4 Capital. And, you know, do you think he is confronting agency issues with this, you know, what he sort of believes is a new model for agencies?
Yeah. So, you know, I'll start off with, there are, you know, many significant turds on the table, but I think most agencies are aware of them and they are confronting them. But there are three very broadly. The first is that traditional advertising in advanced markets, particularly Western Europe and the United States. And if you think of traditional advertising as marketing communication that is underwritten by interruptive ads, whether it's print or television or anything else, that is a long-term secular decline. It's never going to come back. That because of digital, because of things like Netflix, because of a whole bunch of other stuff, that it's not going to be there, but it's going to be a much smaller. And as a result, you have to think less about commercially underwritten advertising and more about things like marketing and experiences and a bunch of other things. Not that that part of advertising won't be around, but it's basically in long-term secular decline. And I said that some time ago, I think 2-3 years ago, that I expected it to be about 30% smaller over 5 years. And we're about 15% smaller already. And you saw, you know, post-COVID-19, I think it was IPG that talks about a 13% decline this year. And I think much of this decline is secular. And so we have to change what we do in the world of marketing and communication. And most businesses are trying to do that, but that is one third of the table. A second third of the table is we have to figure out ways where we work differently in a world where not only is there more technology, but where there is a less and less value for duplication, friction, or other kinds of things. And so, you know, marketers are basically willing to pay a lot, but they're not willing to pay a lot for heat and friction and duplication. And so that is, I think, a lot of the holding companies are sort of optimizing and putting sort of an emphasis on the customer, putting an emphasis on the country. And while brands are still important and the individual agency brands are still important, I think the balance of power and the emphasis is much more on country leaders and client leaders. I know we're doing it, and I said, oh, Publicis, I'm not there anymore, but Publicis was doing it, and as other people. And the third on the table, which I mentioned earlier, is we have to find a way to attract and retain talent. Because in effect, that's eventually what we have, and make the talent's job more interesting. So if we can replace the drudgery, the coordination, the technology-enabled parts that can be done by machines or other things, we should definitely sort of do that. I think all people are sort of doing that. What Martin Sorrell is doing, and you know, S4 has both been, from a small base, been very, very successful, is he's basically focusing almost completely on the digital side of the business, and particularly the algorithmic digital side of the business. which is a fast-growing piece of business. However, I don't believe that any marketer can succeed only on that capability. And so very much like, you know, and Amazon has a Whole Foods and is in various stores and things like that. Marketers are going to basically want omni-channel. They're going to basically want offline and online. And the other is, you know, his business, which again does particularly well, is probably a lot more emphasizing the plumbing, which is important, and less the poetry, which I also believe is important. So I believe marketing is about plumbing and poetry, just like my book said, it's the story and the spreadsheet. And he's emphasizing a lot on the spreadsheet. And I think he will add the story. Most creative agencies started with the story and are grappling with the spreadsheet. And media companies maybe were much on the spreadsheet and were grappling with the, story. But I believe that eventually that anything that his company is particularly doing, other companies can do. And the reality of it is, I'm not exactly sure that he would have created S4 if he had not been sort of asked to leave WPP. So, you know, parts of it makes me wonder whether it's a strategy of vengeance or it's a strategy of convenience.
There certainly seems to be quite a bit of tension there, I think, in
there's a tension that makes absolutely no sense because in effect, you know, if you think about all the stuff that he's done and he's, you know, one of the giants of the industry, whether, you know, you like him as a person or you don't like him as a person is irrelevant. He's created massive amounts of things and he was one of the leaders in creating sort of the holding company model along, you know, with the people who created IPG and obviously Maurice Levy and others. He's sort of one of the three, four giants of the industry. And at the very same stage, S4 is very successful. So the fact that he spends 10 to 15% of his time hating upon where he came from is odd, is the best way I can say. Not necessary, it's odd. And I think it sort of undercuts all the other thing that he's either done or is doing.
Yeah. The thing I saw you say recently was that you feel like the number of people that you admire in the industry is in decline. This is no reference to Martin Sorrell in that context. But why do you think that is? Why do you think you're seeing fewer people around the industry that you feel that you can look up to? I think, you know, the leadership of the large tech giants come under particular scrutiny.
So I think there's a few reasons why. Now, again, the first one maybe just because somewhere along I grew older and I lost the plot. So it may just be like an old curmudgeon who thinks the days were better, which probably explains most of it. But let's assume that maybe I may have something else besides, you know, sort of a out of date, out of sync person. I think there are three big issues here. The first issue is that most of the platform companies, not all of them, most of the platform companies have people who are smart but who are not wise, right? And part of it is because wisdom comes over time and wisdom comes with education. And many of these folks decided not to finish their education and only educated themselves on code. And they tend to be in their 30s, so they haven't basically seen anything, you know, particularly stuff. The other is most of them are controlling shareholders. So nobody can get rid of a Mark Zuckerberg, okay? So, you know, my basic belief is he's obviously brilliant, created amazing amounts of value, controls a $2 billion platform. But in many ways, he's also, as a controlling shareholder, he is the controlling weakness of that company. And there's clearly an indication that he had this amazing board. People who I admired, by the way, on his board, Ken Chanel, the head of Amex, Reed Hastings, right? I think it was Erskine Bowles. Bunches of people, they're all gone, right? And he's got now the head of Dropbox and a bunch of other people. So, you know, in effect, the first is, are these human beings? Are they surrounding themselves with people who question them? If you're so good, why do you have to have so control that nobody, you know, are you like a czar? You know, so many of them behave like little czars or big czars. So that's my stuff is, fine, you're rich, but at some particular stage, how much do you need? Like, what is this? So that's one reason. The second is, you know, a lot of what has also happened is both on the agency and on the client side. At some particular stage when I was growing up, and I've done this in the past and I continue to do it, even though now I don't have any clients, so I can do it. But even when I had clients, and is you got to go to somebody and say, listen, and even if they can fire you, you are wrong, right? They can then tell you why what you think they're wrong about, you're not wrong. But I think there's a sense of fear. And, you know, we've gone to being very transactional, and we're not like as risk-taking as possible. And, you know, it's here's what basically happened. When I was running things, my job was to protect my talent from crazy client activity or from crazy partner activity. So when a client basically called to yell, my job was not to say, okay, client, I'm going to replace this person, or yes, you're right. Obviously, I listened to them, and sometimes there was a reason that they were yelling. But otherwise, my whole stuff is, you don't threaten people here, okay? You don't threaten my people. You just don't do that. It doesn't work. Unless they've really done something, you know, ethically or something else, but you just don't do it. And as a result, what used to happen is I had amazing talent and amazing client relationships. And by the way, the client would call me and say, you are so full of shit, I want to like kick you. But they wouldn't like do something in the back and put me up on review or do some snide fee cutting. They'd basically call me in, they'd kick my butt, and then they'd say, what are you going to do about it? That is what I miss now. Right, I miss the fact that you're good enough to basically stand up for your people. You're good enough to basically take a kicking and keep ticking. And as I guess it was Timex watches. Now everything is so not, and by everything meaning a majority of it. It's not all of it. It's still so like, you know, it's like, do I want? This is what I found. A lot of young people in the company and medium level, not in my company, but across things, simply say, we don't want to grow up to be like our leaders. Okay. I wanted to be like my leaders. I think that when I was leading, there were a lot of people in my teams who wanted to, in their own way, be a better version of me. Okay. That's the key thing, which is, you know, a company where you don't want to grow up to be like your boss or bosses is a company that's in trouble. And that's the key thing. So even if you look at something like Facebook, they're now beginning to have a big problem hiring and retaining their top talent. Not that they still hire, they're very rich, et cetera. But the percentages have gone down from, you know, 92% of engineers would accept their job to 60% of engineers accept their job. And that's primarily because people care about purpose and values. It's not only about money, it's not only about numerics.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do question sometimes when, in spite of every single Facebook, you know, there's been Facebook have been confronted with a different scandal every other week. I think, you know, it's reached people on the political level, on the social level. On pretty much every issue, they've become embroiled on something. Then in terms of advertisers, in terms of metrics, measurement, all the rest of it. And yet they print money quarter after quarter after quarter. Is there a price to pay for not having this soul really in a data-driven networked world?
Yes, I think there is a price. What just happens, the price will come a little later, but here is the price. And I do believe there's a price. First of all, again, I don't believe that today you can market as a marketer without using Facebook and Google. But, you know, I think it's Professor Galloway, Scott Galloway of NYU, basically calls them a tax. Because in effect, if you actually understand how they work, they take away all your margin. That's what they do. You bid against other people, so all the margin goes to them at the end of it. But you can't successfully market. If you want to basically be on social or in search, you can't do without them. And increasingly on e-commerce, you can't do without Amazon. So outside of breaking them up, which is something that I do believe we need to basically do, but that's outside my, you know, pay grade. Here is the real price. There are three prices that every marketer is going to end up paying. And this is what I'm now telling the boardrooms, because it's really interesting. The boardrooms are listening to me, okay? The marketers might not listen. The boardrooms are. And these are the three prices you will pay. Price number one that you will basically pay is you will lose strategic optionality of your business. These people basically, right, own everything and you are reduced to nothing but a factory. They own the consumer, they own the data, they own the search, they own the marketplace, they own the transaction. You own nothing, right? And you just, so number one is that to a great extent, you are putting your business at risk. And even today, when you see these like great graphs with numbers, you know, when people say, I'm doing so well. I said, you're doing really well on these platforms, but how come your business isn't growing, right? Don't you feel like you're in a hospital where you're looking at this like chart or this display which shows that your heart and everything is getting stronger, but you feel really weak, but the doctor is getting fatter? Like, have you thought about that for a second, right? That you should think about your entire business and not just like what one campaign or one effort is doing. So that I think is one, which is you're putting your business potentially at risk. And that will start showing up in the short, medium, and long run, because in effect, the only way that these folks are going to come, like, there's absolutely no doubt that Apple is going to get into education and into healthcare, right? There's absolutely no doubt that Google is going to get into healthcare and travel. And who are the biggest spenders of travel and completely reliant on Google? Expedia and all these companies. So stock price declined by a third when they changed an algorithm. So A, you're putting your business at strategic risk. The second thing that you're basically doing, which is a big problem, is your talent, right? Your customers, your consumers are starting to question. If you think about young people, so if you have like Mark Benioff, who basically compares Facebook to nicotine, right? And some people are asking, who is funding this? Who is funding the polarization of society? And the biggest mistake that people believe is that these are advertising platforms. They're not advertising operating systems. They're society operating systems that are funded by advertising. They are changing society both for the better and for the much worse, funded by advertising. At some particular stage, people are going to question these brands. People are going to question, why didn't you speak up? So one is your future business is at risk, which I basically call strategic optionality. You have a customer risk, which is your, especially younger people under 34 are starting to question this like crazy. That's the second one. And the third, which is a thing that also that one has to basically think about, is you probably are going to be up for lawsuits. So, you know, this data thing is not going away. There's going to be some really odd stuff that's going to happen over time. So you basically have legislative risk, you have business risk, and you have customer risk. And these are don't show up in the campaign. And there's a very simple way, which is you have to have options. You have to have options. You know, marketers have got to have options. The fact that they don't have options means these companies can do whatever they want. And I've been taught by the world's best marketers, they could replace me in 15 seconds, which they often did, though sometimes I beg them not to, and they'd go to another agency, consultancy, et cetera. Who can they replace these people with? Is that a sign of strength? All their money, 105% of Google's profits come from advertising because all these other bets they lose money on, right? But you have no control. Facebook is all advertising. You have no control.
I agree. Over the course of your career, you've sort of seen the first iterations of, you know, machine learning and AI being introduced into the business sphere. Again, this sort of feeds into our overarching dystopian narrative that, you know, we're going to see huge job losses across various different types of industries, and that we're going to see there could be all sorts of unforeseen consequences of AI. Do you feel optimistic about AI being used in marketing and for society generally?
There's a series of articles on AI in the latest Economist magazine. That's the cover story of the Economist is about, at least in the US edition, is about protesting, the George Floyd protest, where that in many cases, AI has been overhyped, especially in things like driving, you know, auto driving, et cetera, because the problem simply is that AI and machine learning is backward looking in a forward looking world. So, and human beings don't behave like machines. So sometimes it's a little bit difficult, but I do believe that the power of machine learning and natural language processing is very powerful. And what I hear is doubling its capability every 6 months. And that application, I do believe that machine learning will change the future of marketing, along with 5G and new forms of interface like voice. And the way I point it is this. Already today, even though most people only use 4 or 5 skills, I think like there are 80 million homes in America that have either a Google Home, Amazon, Echo, et cetera. And if you look at those devices, they are what I call a third connected age device. They use machine learning to natural language processing, machine learning to understand. They have a new interface, which is voice. They access the world through clouds. So I believe 5G, voice, and cloud are three of the big things in the new connected age. And then the fourth one is 5G. And 5G is for real going to be very, very prevalent, I think, around the world by the end of 2021. And there are two parts of 5G that are particularly interesting. The first one is that it's much faster, 100 times faster than you currently have, more than 100, and 100 times faster than the fastest speeds, and 1,000 times faster than average speeds, which is pretty amazing. But it also basically has no drop-off, and so you're going to be able to do amazing things on it. But now if you sort of think about all of these, they power machine learning and AI, and you begin to have these little devices all around you that not only can monitor, but you can talk to, you can do all kinds of things. I think it's going to change experience. It's going to change customer service. It's going to change marketing in amazingly broad ways. And what I worry about is that if we don't watch it, all of this next generation will go to exactly the same companies because they have the engineers, they have the capital, but more importantly, they have the data.
So as a final question, I've been offering people 100 million, and I'm afraid in your case, I'm going to reduce it to 10 million. When I offer people 100 million of imaginary money to invest, they tend to sort of to start doing PE roll-ups and it all gets a bit confusing. So I'm thinking to change the rules of this final question. So if it's going to be 10 million, but you're not allowed to take it out for another 10 years. So you basically have to do a Warren Buffett investment. Where would you invest it in our industry? And why?
I would invest it in three parts in our industry. I would try to find the smartest people that I can, or companies that are smaller but have lots of smart people, and I would invest in them and ask them to build me the service partner. I won't even call it an agency anymore. The service, but clearly service. Okay, the service partner for the third connected age, for an age where, in addition to mobile and social and search and commerce, all of which will be around, 5G and voice and cloud things like cloud, 5G, voice will be, and AI will be big parts of the future. So build me that. So that would be sort of one area I would invest in. The other area that I would basically invest in is I would try to do a deal with the leading MFA schools in America, and basically say I will fund, I will help underwrite or subsidize 3 or 4 of your top students in return for them working with my company for 3 years. So they pay it off. So it's like I'll pay for 3-4 years of their education, but their first 3-4 years. Because I believe the MFA is going to be the new MBA. So whether you go to the MFA at NYU or USC or various else, because that's my other thing on talent. So one is align with the trends of the future. So find industry companies that are already starting to work in those areas and build around them. Second is invest in talent and next generation of talent coming out of schools that I would definitely basically sort of do. And in addition to the MFA talent, I would actually go and basically try to go to the very best schools that turn out, you know, the Harvard University, Harvard and other universities for African Americans, Hispanic, you know, Native Indian, or in whatever country you are in. Because I truly believe that if you have aligned with the right trend and you have the right talent, you basically are in great shape. And then the last part of money that I would basically do if I had some money left over from my, you know, 10 million or whatever, would be go find a few amazing leaders from, you know, with some gray, not necessarily gray hair, but some sort of wisdom to help guide these people. Because most of these people who create amazing companies, you know, are both younger, utilizing newer technologies, but sometimes they need a little bit of wisdom, and then you can add a little bit of that to them. But really, it's about trend and talent. I always want to invest in trend and talent in the service business. And broadly, if you want me to invest broadly, I would basically say invest in 5G and biotech.
I think they're fantastic answers. I'm still waiting for somebody to say trade publications about digital advertising, but I think you're working towards far more noble and interesting causes there. Richard, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. Hopefully this was useful.
Super useful. In fact, yeah, I sort of regret that we have a time limit at all, but such is life. Thanks again.
Absolutely. And if people want to keep in touch with me, they can find me on @Rishad at Twitter. And if they want to give me $2.50, which is what I get every time I sell a book, go to Amazon and type in my name.
Excellent. All right. Well, I've already bought mine, but yeah, I'll encourage others to do the same.
You bet.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.